I can eat a peach for hours.
Do you want lunch?
You're A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
I can't talk too long. I gotta poo.
Oh, no, not the peach! Not the peach! Ah!
It's like looking in a mirror.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Travolta Cage, a podcast about the two greatest actors in movie history. I'm Clint Worthington, editor-in-chief of The Spool and senior writer for Consequence of Sound.
I am Nathan Rabin of Nathan Rabin's Happy Place, and also I'm a sleazy whore.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm more of a Gatsby girl, but we have a very special guest who we love to have on all the time, always. Please just join our cadre of fools here. Andrew Jupin. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, fellas, and I am a Gatsby whore. That's what I'll be.
Oh, like putting both of them in a fly machine and...
Yeah, exactly right.
Yes. Jay Brundlesby.
Grundleize that shit.
Grendelize, yes. As you know, or maybe in case you don't, this podcast discusses the careers of one John Travolta and Nicolas Cage, and we're comparing their careers chronologically throughout the 40-plus years they've been, you know, on screen for good and for ill. And we're talking about a couple of really interesting movies that have a lot of curious parallels, which I found interesting. There's John Travolta's breakout Saturday Night Fever and Racing with the Moon, where Nick Cage is like third fiddle, like next to Sean Penn and Elizabeth McGovern.
Can I just say really quickly, I think, first of all, that this is a fantastic idea for a podcast. You two are geniuses, combining these two fucking titans here. And it was interesting to me, I realized, because...
Which is funny, because at this point in their career, they are, in fact, teen titans.
Yes.
That's true, they are both teens.
They are
teens,
so
yeah.
Baby-faced and teenager.
And we are going to their movies.
But I realized that in my stock and trade on We Hate Movies, I'm dealing with these guys in a completely different way. but I just realized watching both of these movies, it was a nice reminder for me, like, oh yeah, these guys were great at one point.
Right. And by the way, for your other work, why don't you tell people where they can find your stuff in case they don't know?
Yeah, I host the We Hate Movies podcast. It's over at whmpodcast.com. We're on the HeadGum Network, and we do have a Patreon, patreon.com/WeHateMovies. We're a comedy show that talks about movies and TV and, you know, usually in the science fiction, horror, action realm, but, you know, have tackled all kinds. Erotic thrillers like Nicolas Cage's Zondali, which you guys will get to sooner or later. That's my stock and trade. We Hate Movies.
Well, and a nice bit of synchronicity, the last movie that just posted was a Nicolas Cage movie, was it not?
That's right. Yeah, we just released a live episode we did on our West Coast tour. We were in San Francisco, appropriately enough, talking about The Rock. And if you think that we schedule live shows based on where we're going and what movie we're talking about, yes, we absolutely do that.
Talk about
being whores and, you know, just leaving it right out there for the audience. But we were talking about The Rock. It was fucking great. I love that movie. And
it's so good.
Unsurprisingly, I had never seen Racing with the Moon before 2 hours ago.
Nor had I. I mean, I guess I watched it a little earlier this morning, but still, today was my first time. And actually, I think for the first time last night, I saw Saturday Night Fever. I don't think I'd ever seen it.
Holy
wow,
fucking
nice.
Shit. How did you make it this far into your 30s without saying Saturday? It's like literally maybe one of the 10 most iconic movies in American film history.
I think it's one of those things where it is so seeped into the cultural consciousness that I think part of me felt like I didn't need to watch it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I got the essential beats just through existing in the miasma of pop culture, you know?
So my question for you here is, it's kind of like listening to a James Brown CD or like a Parliament Funkadelic after everybody has sampled them. Did it feel like really weird sense of deja vu? Because so much of this film has just been ripped off and copied and just shamelessly stolen from. I guess in particular, sort of a Boogie Nights. Yeah. Did you feel like you were watching a Boogie Nights reboot?
There was a little bit of Boogie Nights in there, and there was weirdly a lot of Taxi Driver, I think, just in that conception of a grimy kind of 70s New York. Obviously, this is the sunnier side of it, a little bit.
It's not that. It's honestly that not much
sunnier. It's like...
I think, honestly, Taxi Driver is like one of the only films you could say, like, yeah, honestly, this is substantially darker than Saturday Night Fever because it goes to some unbelievably dark places. Like, growing up, what was your conception of Saturday Night Fever? Because it had such a huge place in the culture.
For context, I think I need to let our listeners know that I literally grew up on a farm for the first 18 years of my life.
Just like Superman.
I mean, you can tell in my thick Southern drawl, my thick Midwestern drawl, that I'm such a country boy.
Was it a fully functioning farm, by the way? I have to know. Like,
it was like a corn soybeans kind of sitch.
Okay, so no animals or anything? Like, not a livestock? Or...
Yeah, no, real, like, Monsanto fuel kind of stuff.
Oh, wow, okay, nice.
Yeah, whoops. It's okay, my dad's not going to listen to this.
You know what time somebody told me I was good in my life? Two, twice. This raise today and dance at the disco. Well, I mean, I could dance with you, but you know, you're not my dream girl or nothing like that.
Are you as good in bed as you are on that dance floor?
Don't know what you make it with some of these chicks. They think you gotta dance with them.
He's very good, yeah. He's the best. Hey, man, he's great. He's the king out there.
John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever.
She can dance, you know that? She's got the wrong partner, of course, but she can dance.
Okay, listen. I like it. We could dance together. That's it. We could just dance together and nothing more, nothing personal.
So many people who know of Saturday Night Fever know only of the opening credits sequence, really. Like that iconic walk down the street to Staying Alive, you know, the close-up shot of the boots, his outfit, and walk striding confidently, probably too slowly for what is supposed to be an errand, like a quick errand, like he's supposed to be at work. But
well, he's
I suppose
strutting,
that's the point.
You know, he's strutting. He's got a sense of rhythm and musicality.
You know, for a lot of it, I was like, so what is this movie going to be about? I know he disco dances, but is that it? And because I think the rest of it, that sort of drama about growing up and trying to find your place and escaping the doldrums of your week every Saturday night to like find yourself in a place where you are celebrated instead of, you know, marginalized. I think that's really that kind of stuff is really interesting and is also not part of the cultural conversation. I don't know what it is. I think just people nowadays didn't want to talk about scenes of gang rape and falling off of bridges.
Well, I think it's a thing where, like, that stuff isn't, and I, by the way, I should say, I only saw this for the first time maybe, like, 8 years ago, but I think I shared the same sort of take on it as you did, Clint, where it's like, you know, I saw this parodied in fucking Tiny Toons, like, I know what it is, and, you know, and I think that's why, you know, we don't talk about, you know, the gang rape and the wanting to get out of your shitty, you know, family neighborhood and whatever. It's because that stuff can't be parodied in pop culture, but like you want to have a fucking, you know, a cartoon rabbit, you know, disco dancing. Like, obviously you can do that. Like, everybody remembers the strut. Nobody remembers that during the strut, he's holding a can of paint hilariously. You know, nobody remembers him shoving two slices of pizza into his mouth at the same time.
Well, that was the Spielberg re-edit. They edited, he used to be holding a gun, but they CGI'd that out to a can of paint. It was very strange.
Well, brilliant. I feel like that's one of the many infinitely fascinating things about this is it was supposed to be based on a true story by a guy named Nick Cohn, who totally just made that bullshit up. And again,
I learned that for the first time last night, and my God, I was stunned.
It's fucking fascinating. And again, I think kind of the idea there was to provide sort of a sociological context, sort of a sociological exploration for something that seemed very stupid and very facile, which was disco dancing as a craze and as a lifestyle as well.
Yeah, because the whole deal was that he's an English writer who had just moved to the United States, too, I think. So, like, by the time he got assigned this thing, he was like, I don't get any of this. This is not my scene, man. And so I'm just going to base Tony Manero off of, like, this mod kid that I knew in England, in jolly old England. And I kind of wish that Travolta had played that. I wish he had gone sort of full fanatic, like, English Bobby with this.
Well, and it's interesting to me, too, because the original director of this was John Avildsen, who the year before directed Rocky, you know, which, I don't know, obviously the hot, probably the best credit you could have to direct something like this. But he got fired pretty early on and replaced by John Badham. And there's an interesting you know, sort of bit of, I guess, a proto-Easter egg, and that there's that picture of Rocky
right,
on Tony's wall. And then if you noticed also, there's a picture of Al Pacino from Serpico. And that's also a little bit of an Easter egg because Serpico was written by Norman Wexler, who also wrote Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah. Ooh, and it's so interesting to go back to the 70s and 80s and sort of remember this conception of Robert De Niro as a hunkosaurus. Like, John Travolta aspires to be as hot as Al Pacino.
I think you're saying Al Pacino. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Al Pacino, yeah. But he, you know, he wants to... sorry, I lost my train of thought.
It is amazing watching the... Oh, did you catch it? You
got Yeah, okay. Sorry. So in a world where I feel like our most, you know, immediate conception of Al Pacino is Jimmy Hoffa and The Irishman.
Right.
It's funny to go back and think about what a hunkosaurus he used to be and how he was a sex symbol, you know?
Oh, yeah. It's totally wild. I mean, we just had, you know, cleverly AMC or IFC, one of the cable channels, was doing the first two Godfathers on Thanksgiving night. And so, of course, we're sitting there tuning in and I'm looking at him and I was like, my... God, look at Al Pacino in both of these movies. Whereas more recently, I saw The Irishman, and then I saw him walk out on stage to do the Q&A in where he's like got this old man hunch going on now, and he was wearing this huge scarf. He could have been a hobbit, you know. And I was like, these are two starkly different people.
Yeah, he's somehow sort of aged into a tiny Jewish man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a little bit. Which makes sense because he is going to be playing like the head of a group of Jewish Nazi hunters in some Amazon series.
What in the world is that?
Executive
show?
Produced by Jordan Peele.
Yeah.
Is that right? Oh, wow.
He says the phrase, it's not murder, it's mitzvah. Without an ounce of irony. That's peak Pacino.
I feel like you should have like a needle point. That says it's not murder, it's a mitzvah.
Let's put that next to bless this mess.
So yeah. Let's talk about this motion picture in which there are not a lot of mitzvahs committed. So we start off with Tony Manera, who John Travolta plays as a 19-year-old who works at a paint store and is very well liked at the paint store, but he fucking hates his life, and he has this miserable, very shitty, very small existence that becomes, you know, an MGM musical, becomes this glorious thing when he goes to the disco. And one of the things that I found really fascinating about Saturday Night Fever is when they were making it, they took great pains to ensure that none of the moves were new. The idea being that in this disco, it's kind of a shitty, lame place where everything would be at least 6 months old. So everything that was happening in here was kind of dated and kind of lame and kind of pathetic. And that's one of the things that I feel makes this such a poignant and powerful film, is that there's just so much sadness. And it feels like kind of the music and the dance is kind of the one thing that kind of cuts through the sadness and cuts through the despair.
Yeah, those early scenes of disco dancing were really fascinating to me, because I think going back to our earlier question about why I didn't see it that often is because it feels so very much of its time. Like it was a movie that started a trend.
Well, it's like one of the most 1970s movies ever made. If somebody were to say, you know, give me five movies that would explain the 1970s, this would be one of them.
But this movie was also sort of like, it's interesting, this movie was like the paddles to the heart of disco, because I mean, this is 77, disco was on its way out, and then when this happened, it got popular again, and it gave itself like two more years of life.
Oh yeah, it fucking exploded. I mean, this was one of the most successful and one of the most influential soundtrack albums of all time. And I recently watched Superfly for a column that I do for TCM Backlot. And with that, there was kind of a similar dynamic where the music is so seductive and so sexy and so glamorous and fun that it makes you almost ignore that the stuff that's around it is so gritty and grimy and not just depressing, but fucking grim. I mean, you take the disco out of this and this is like a fucking miserablest, you know, practically, you know, sort of neorealist exploration of
what it's like to be young and have nothing. I felt like I was watching like a fucking miserable Mike Lee social drama.
Yeah.
Because the second you close down 2001 Odyssey, the disco club they go to, which brilliant name.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right, Nathan. Like, all that's left is just fucking misery and hell and desperation. And it's incredibly sad.
It's funny that Pacino sort of comes up in the aesthetics of the movie and he even quotes Dog Day Afternoon because this feels like a little bit like a Sidney Lumet picture. I feel like it's the kind of thing he could have directed minus the disco scenes. Maybe well, even it, with. I don't know his
well,
talents.
And it's so incredibly well, he directed The Wiz.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to say that he was not good at directing disco musicals. Yeah. That was kind of a flaw. But one of the things that I love, love, love about it, it's so incredibly class conscious, down to like almost like a microbial type of level. There's this wonderful scene where he sees this awesome disco shirt and he goes into the store and he says, can I put the shirt on layaway, and it's such a thing where like even this everything that he has goes towards this fantasy, towards this escape where he can be something more than what he is during his day-to-day life, which is just sad. And you see the example of his father, who is a construction worker who worked and hasn't worked for 7 months. And because of that, his whole identity, his whole sense of self has been undermined. You know, he's nothing if he's not working. Whereas, you know, with his son, he's nothing at work. You know, it's mm-hmm. the world that exists outside of work where he is a king, whereas the world at work, he's a pauper. And the world within his family, he's a pauper as well.
And the only other male figure besides the father that he can go to is this older brother character who's a priest. And that is a fucking dead end as far as Tony Manero is concerned.
Right. And also, well, especially because the brother comes back and he leaves the priesthood. And that seems mm-hmm. to unmoor Tony in ways that he probably didn't expect as well. Which I found very interesting.
But again, they pay so much attention to sort of the complicated emotional dynamics here, because there's also a sense that Tony has risen, his stock has risen in the family. Because before, the priest was, you know, literally their connection to God, and Tony was just this asshole who liked to disco dance. And then once he's no longer a priest, he no longer has the kind of cachet, he no longer has the value. And that's, I think that this is very interesting kind of on a transactional level, is like, what are people's cultural cachet? What do they bring to the world? What do they have? But yeah, so you have two different women in Tony's life. You have Stephanie Mangiano, who's this really, really interesting characterization, very 1970s, where she is Tony's idea of like a really classy lady, like a step up, like somebody who's educated, somebody who knows about the world. And in his mind, you know, she is Audrey Hepburn. You know, she has class, she has made it. And then to us, she's this very poignantly class-conscious striver who desperately, desperately wants people to think that she's made it, that she's successful. She spends a lot of time name-dropping in ways that are kind of hilarious. She talks about David Bowie as being the kind of like person she encounters in her day-to-day
life. She's like a hyper-aware Eliza Doolittle.
Yeah, very much so. Well, and she's trying to be, you know, trying to create herself and not quite making it. And then on the other end, you have Annette, who is this girl who is absolutely obsessed with Tony, who sort of follows after him like a little puppy. And they went on a date once. And again, this is the reality of like, for Tony, this was nothing. This was one shitty evening of her life. And for her, this was everything. You know, this was their grand love affair. This was what, you know, it's supposed to give them a relationship after that. And there are so many just desperately, desperately sad moments in their relationship, one of which is he leaves the disco feeling angry and frustrated and horny, as he usually is, and she just presents this handful of condoms.
Not just a condom, by the way. A handful.
We're going to do this.
Oh, God. Oh, and there are so many elements. Again, it's fucking fascinating to me that they made a PG-rated version of this because they thought everybody should be able to enjoy John Travolta's performance, a.k.a. we should be able to make $15 million out of this thing.
Was and the movie like 20 minutes shorter, though?
Well, one thing you would have to change is that the dudes, you know, Tony and his horrible, horrible crew, they take girls to the car and they have 10 minutes to fuck them. And then after that 10 minutes, they have to get out so that another person come in and have horrible, degrading, awful sex with somebody. And yeah, that's, again, like, how do you play that in the PG rated version?
Yeah, I feel like the movie's gotta end after the dance contest.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
You just have to, like, cut everything else, right?
He gets that fucking trophy and it cuts to credits. We don't even see him giving it, like, to the Puerto Rican couple. No, it's just like, they're the winners. Good night, everybody. Directed by John Badham.
I feel like it's kind of the PG rated version of Deadpool. Except not presented as a joke, presented as something serious.
Right.
Right. But who does Fred Savage play in this version of Saturday Night Fever? Right. But you mentioned the shitheel friends too, and I think we should talk about them too, because that is also like, that's one of the more severe influences in his life. I mean, there's this whole like, I mean, you know, with the disco craze and everything and the way he looks in the movie, it's a very sort of almost like androgynous kind of metrosexual sort of look, the haute couture shirts and the bell bottoms and the tight pants and everything else. But he does hang out with this very much more traditionally masculine group of guys that,
I think there's an intense sense of homoeroticism. And I think what you have in a lot of societies of young men is that there will be overt homophobia. They will have to establish, I'm not gay. I'm making fun of gay people fucking suck, as a way of denying themselves, I'm sexually attracted to some of my friends.
And those dudes, Double J and Joey, I mean, those guys.
Bobby, like, in particular.
Bobby has such a tragic
crush.
Just the way Tony, they're looking at Tony is like, it's all right
it's
there.
It's with like lust and envy.
Yes,
yeah.
Well, and they follow after him like he's like they're puppies. You know, they're little lost puppies, and he's as lost as any of them. And I think that's one of the things that's so desperately sad about this, is that everybody is looking to Tony for direction and for leadership, and he's just a fuck-up who's good at dancing and very handsome.
Yeah. If the last few years have taught us anything, is that being good at one thing doesn't make you good at everything else, and that's something these kids needed to learn.
Absolutely, but that's what's also, like, so endlessly sad, like the layers of sadness, like you don't think you could even get people sadder than Tony, but like these people that think that Tony's the one who's got it figured out, fuck me, man.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, like Bobby, for, you know, if nothing else, that poor guy, like, ugh, who's just trying to figure out, like, he's gotten in trouble and he's gotten his girlfriend pregnant. And that scene, like, one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when he's talking to Tony's brother and trying desperately to get his attention.
Yeah.
And it's so, like, about, like, hey, do you think the Pope would give me special dispensation for an abortion? You can work it out, right? Yeah. It's ridiculous on its face, but there's such like an element of sadness to it and desperation. This kid does not know what to do.
Absolutely.
And he goes looking to everybody for advice, looking to everybody for counsel, looking to everybody for just like a sympathetic shoulder to cry on. And you really get the sense that he needs to die in order for people to care about him. He needs to die in order to matter. He needs to die in order to be seen. Which is one of the many, many unbelievably dark messages you see in this classic pit of Americana.
In this fun disco movie that the Tiny Toons fucking parody. Yeah. You know? I mean, this is a fascinating fucking movie, top to bottom, but also just like, I am just becoming more and more fascinated as we talk about it now, just the way in which we have conveniently scraped, I would say, a safe, like, what, 40% of this movie?
Oh, maybe. And you watch it now and it's so resonant because it's such a story about toxic masculinity and about these men who hate women and who fear women and who do not understand women. And because of that, they treat
And people
them
of color,
terribly.
Too. Let's be clear about that, too.
Oh, they're racist pieces of shit. And I was thinking about this today because, like, John Travolta was a fucking, you know, he was the boy in the plastic bubble. He was Barbarino. He was a huge, wholesome movie star. I was like, imagining Justin Bieber making a movie in which he uses the C word repeatedly, and he uses the S word repeatedly, and he drops the N bomb, and plays all of the, and I mean, the fact that the character is at all sympathetic, that we care about, that we like him at all, I think is a testament to what an incredibly charismatic performer. And also to how many layers there are to the character, where he's, again, horrible and awful, but he's also a product of his environment. He's also somebody who brings out the worst in the people around him, and who, you know, being part of this group of awful men, it just, yeah, it forces them to be the worst possible versions of themselves.
Yeah, I think it's really important to talk about Travolta's performance in this, because it is, it does feel at once of a piece with early Travolta stuff, and at once incredibly revelatory. I mean, if think of for no other reason than, like, his moves, man. Like, he's just, he, it's absolutely him putting everything out there on the stage, and his physicality is so sort of chameleonic, and sort of, it's very peacocky, it's very showy, it's very look at me, but in this way that, like, you know, it informs the character.
Well, there's a great sense of process as well, too. It's not just that he's this gorgeous creature. You see him getting dressed. You see him combing his hair. You see him getting upset when people hit him in the hair. You know, there's that creature too. He goes, the hair, don't touch the hair.
That reminded me of how much I didn't realize that Uncle Jesse from Full House is modeled after Tony Manero.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, but in a less rapey fashion, I would hope. But again, but you also have him, like, God, there's this heartbreaking line where, you know, he's talking to Annette, who just wants to be with him more than anything in the world. And he says, you know, are you a nice girl? Are you a C word?
Yeah.
And in his mind, those are the only two things in the world. You know, you're either a whore or you're a girl that he could get married and bring, you know, mom home to. Right. And of course, the horrible catch 22 is that, you know, if you have sex, that means you're not worth anything. And again, that so much of this movie is this just tragic attempt by these sad, desperate people to get the attention of somebody who just, yeah, who's just in this narcissistic bubble.
Even in his big sort of woke moment when he, like, realizes that he shouldn't have won the dance contest, he still keeps dropping S-bombs. And I found that a very interesting divide, that, like, he realizes the injustice of what was done to them and that he doesn't deserve to win. But he's like, yeah, yeah, that S-word needs to, you know, he deserves to win. I'm going to give it back to him.
Well, I think because in his mind, I mean, that's just
there's what no you offense call in those it.
People. Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's why it's his just mind, so at least. Free flowing like that. Yeah, in his mind, yeah. Absolutely. You know, in his 1976 brain. Right. But yeah, no, it is really one of, I think, the greatest magic tricks of this movie, that you wind up by the last line, which is a fucking heartbreaking line. You know, it's just so feeling for this character, and it's all because of Travolta.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also I think because some of the other characters around him are even more disgusting. One of my favorite characters in this movie and all of 1970s cinema is the guy who runs the dancing studio. Who says, hey, how's it going? He goes, holding steady at 65%. And that 65% is he has sex with 65% of the women who come in there. And it's so fucking disgusting and so gross. And also just the fact that he is a physically very unappealing man.
Yeah,
he's got like that. He's got that child molester mustache. He's got, you know, he's clearly going bald. But you squeeze him into tight enough clothes and put him into this scene where that's so sexual and everybody's fucked up out of their mind. And he suddenly becomes, you know, this stud and Lothario, to the point where, like, you know, he tries to fuck the women that Tony is obsessed with and that Tony sees as being hopelessly out of his league because she, like, has a semester of community college to her name.
I guess going back to the disco scenes, too, I mean, I thought it was very interesting. I didn't realize at first that 2001 Odyssey was supposed to be deliberately bad and dated disco.
Yeah.
I was like,
yeah,
oh, definitely. No, is this what the movie's going to be like? Is disco just line dancing for perverts? And so it was great to see, like, the stage clear for Travolta to sort of do his thing.
Well, and there's that famous where apparently they were going to cut that. They were going to cut that as like, this is 4 minutes that we can totally cut out. We can, you know, get in 90 minutes. And then Trolls had a really, really fight and said, I spent, you know, 6 months learning how to be a great disco dancer. You can't, you know, remove the four best minutes of this movie. And again, it so much better for it, where this wonderland, this paradise in the midst of just so much ugliness and so much 1970s New York.
How ill-equipped he is to bring that same sense of confidence and panache to the rest of his life. I mean, and sort of not really be able to stand up for himself in the way he really needs to, whether it's with his family or even in that terrible scene near the end where, like, Annette's getting gang raped by his friends and he's sort of cowed into not saying anything.
He's sitting in the front seat just like smoking and staring like a zombie, and it's fucking haunting.
Yeah. It's so unbelievably sad. And again, just the idea that, you know, there's also a great performance by Denny Dillon, who went on to become a cast member on Saturday Night Live. And then she was Brian Benman's secretary in Dream On.
Oh, wow.
Where she's somebody who's
Toby.
Yeah, and she's even more so than Annette. She's like, I literally, like, I'm a slave before you. Like, will you allow me to wipe the brow from your forehead? Like, I'm so obsessed with just getting close to you, just being around the magic. And again, that's the painful irony, is that at 2001, a Disco Odyssey, everybody can't wait to, you know, be next to the magic, can't wait to get close to this, you know, magnificent physical specimen. And outside of that world, he's nothing. And he's got nothing going on. And even being an incredibly good-looking, charismatic, handsome dude who dances really well, like, that's still not enough to get by in this world that's very, very harsh and very, very brutal and beats people down the way his brother and his father.
Yeah, I was going to say, I love the exchange he has with, I don't know if it's Double J or Joey, but when Denny Dillon is, you know, brushing the sweat off his brow and one of them's like, you know, oh, Tony, come on, like, you could be getting a blowjob. And he's like, no. This is better than getting a blowjob. You can get anybody to give you a blowjob, but you got to be like a special kind of fucking swinging dick to have somebody come up and want to just wipe the sweat off your face. And I think like just that encapsulates right there like how much he is the king of 2001, A Disco Odyssey.
He does have big disco energy.
And there's also, again, these lines that just show you this world so poignantly. One of which I'm saying that, like, I'm really old. Like, I feel like I'm really old. Like, I only have a little bit amount of time left. And you're 19 years old. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting to see this, you know, in 2019, you know, 43 years later. Yeah.
It's kind of interesting because I also took that line because it's when he's talking to her, talking to Stephanie about, you know, wanting to dance. And, you know, there's only so much time you can physically be a dancer in whatever capacity, social or professional. And he's realizing also, like, so when that time's up, then I literally have nothing. So I have to figure out what, you know, because he's asking her, like, what is that thing that does it for you? Because I got to fucking find something as my clock is ticking.
Right. You could transplant that exchange into like a sports movie, you know what I mean? Or anything involving like vigorous physical activity. We were talking about cameos earlier. I think we should also mention baby Fran Drescher's in this. Which is a cute little scene.
As one of many women who really, really want to fuck John Travolta.
Also, but she's not good enough of a dancer.
Also a lot of dudes who want to fuck John Travolta. And yeah, there's another, so many great, great, great lines in this. One of which is, you know, you make it with a girl. She thinks all of a sudden she can dance with you. That's such a wonderful reversal there, where again, dancing is a really intimate, sexy, wonderful thing, and then fucking is just something you do to pass the time,
right?
And because you're really high and you've got 10 minutes in the backseat of the fuck car. And then you guys want to talk about the Mexican gang and the role that they play in the story?
Oh, the Barracudas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ooh, Barracudas. It's a real Warriors kind of detour there.
So's their fucking clubhouse that gets crashed at the end. the paint job on this garage door was very bright and Warriors-esque.
Honestly, I did kind of check out during that part because I was like, oh, okay, this is sort of like the requisite action scene. Because there's been a lot of talking up to this point, but they don't have a dance scene yet. So we need to just like have him, you know, punch up some ne'er-do-wells.
Yeah, they're like, well, it's not West Side Story, so he can't dance with the Barracudas. I guess they have to fight them.
Well, there's this great explication of just how meaningless all of this was, that they have this big rumble and they fight, yeah. And then they realize, like, oh, wait, it wasn't the actual guys. It's like, they were Mexican, they could have been, you never know. And again, it's this whole thing where, like, oh, these things that these people care about, that they're emotionally invested in, just don't matter, which I think kind of extends to the climax where Tony and his incredibly boring partner. And also what's kind of fascinating to me is that I feel like John Travolta is so much sexier than everybody else in the movie, including the women, that there's kind of a beauty to him that you don't necessarily have from the woman who who's the fancy lady?
Oh, Karen Lynn Gordon.
The classy bride. Yes. You don't necessarily have from that. You kind of feel like he's definitely objectified in a way that other people aren't, including the women.
Well, you have the amazing shot at the beginning of the movie when he's getting ready, and it's just Travolta in that fucking banana hammock.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like the camera's like on the floor, like pointed right at his taint. It's unbelievable. And it's just like, look at the piece of ass we have here.
Well, and this is, I think, is a conscious choice where I feel like they made a decision for a lot of the sort of disco scenes are shot subjectively from Tony Manera's perspective.
Right.
So when you see things from him, they're much more interesting and exciting and sexual, and then there will be a shot that's more objective and you will see like, oh, this is a shitty neighborhood, you know, there's dirt everywhere, right. Everybody here is fucking miserable, so yeah, you kind of have to see it through his disco glasses for things to be exciting and dynamic and full of energy and fun and not just bleak and miserable.
Right. Well, and they throw those disco glasses in front of the camera so many times. I mean, that opening, that iconic opening montage, you know, the title sequence is, you know, treats him like a god. We're looking at him from, you know, a low angle, and we're closing in on the ominous sort of, not ominous, but just celebratory, I guess, like stomp down the street.
Right.
And then when it's not, when he's not at 2001 Odyssey, or when he's not preening for this, in cultivating this image, it is filmed like a traditional kind of 70s studio melodrama.
So Andrew, as a New York guy, how did that affect the way that you saw this movie?
I am a huge sucker for 1970s on location New York movies.
Fucking A, me too.
So you know, it's a thing where it's a time travel kind of thing, right? Which is the brilliance of the entire medium altogether. So I'm always a sucker for looking for stuff like this, and this movie predominantly takes place in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, which is the neighborhood in Brooklyn you always don't want to hear that's where your friend is moving, because it takes fucking forever to get there from anywhere. So it's fascinating to see Bay Ridge on screen. Doesn't happen too often. We're getting a lot of play here with the Verrazano Bridge, of course, playing a big role in the movie. So for me, it's just such a delight to see that stuff and have it be real and not, you know, faked. Not a lot of, like, you know, studio sets and whatnot. We're actually, like, in shitty houses and in Bay Ridge and things like that, and the cafes in the neighborhood and stuff, and also really great subway stuff. Although I will say, at the end of the movie when he rides up to see her, you know, I guess she's supposed to be like maybe the village, or possibly with those brownstones, like Upper East Side, maybe. They never really specify, I don't think. But either way, it's not taking him till the sun rises to get there by subway, unless it's like he's leaving the disco or the bridge scene situation at like 6 o'clock in the morning. So I was like, wait, the sun's out now? Okay, I guess. Maybe they just cut out a bunch of scenes of him riding back and forth on the line or something. But yeah, so a roundabout way to say stuff like this is a total treat for me to see the city that I love and live in represented so grittily and grossly on film.
Would you say that New York is like another character in Saturday Night Fever?
I like the idea that it's about people who, you know, the one of the ways you've already won is if you can just get across the bridge, right? Yeah. The idea that, like, you just leave Brooklyn for Manhattan, especially because nowadays it's kind of totally the opposite. You know, I live in Manhattan now, and, you know, Brooklyn has exploded in a way that it really wasn't in the 1970s. So it's kind of this weird notion almost of like they want to flee Brooklyn. Like now people are, you know, drawn there.
Interesting. Interesting. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess we have our notes and stuff. We're, there's a question here. Is Tony Manero a monster? I think that's a really interesting sort of discussion to have. Because like we said, you know, he's a very morally gray guy. Like he's torn between, you know, he does all kinds of really terrible stuff. But it feels so much like he's a product of his environment. And that if he had another choice, he would take it.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know.
It's tough because I don't think it's clear cut, but it's one of those like, sure, you can be a product of your environment. But, you know, when your friends are gang raping a close associate of yours in the backseat of a car and you're
you
just
should
kind
be
of
doing
sitting,
something.
Yeah. You know, you should be fucking acting on that. And even before, I mean, the cruelty, you know, put on that woman, Annette is the character also. Also happening on the Verrazano Bridge earlier in the movie where they all pretend to fall off and they're fucking with her and she's like destroyed again and they're all like laughing at her. You know, I don't know if monster is the right word, but he is a piece of shit.
Yeah, he's got some growing up to do.
Yeah.
Well, and one attribute that of Saturday Night Fever that I think we should really talk about is the soundtrack, which obviously was iconic. It was like the, I mean, my wife, who used to work at a mall kiosk for half price theater tickets, when we were watching this for the podcast, she got like almost like Vietnam flashbacks of like all the songs that were just burned in her genetic. She found herself mouthing along to the words and she's like, why do I know this? And then she realized right away and it was terrifying. But
was she devastated that it's like built in forever?
Yeah, I think it's coded into her genetic memory at this point.
Yeah, it was the best-selling soundtrack. Not only the best-selling soundtrack, but the best-selling album for a very, very long time. And it's kind of fascinating that it made the Bee Gees the biggest names in disco and also kind of synonymous with disco because they started from a very different place. They were kind of Australia's answer to the Beatles for a lot of late 60s and 70s. But my God, they fucking took to disco like a motherfucker. Like nobody ever took to disco the way that the Bee Gees took to disco. And I think it's kind of like Superfly, which I watched fairly recently, where just the lushness and the gorgeousness and the bliss, the sublime bliss of the soundtrack is very much at odds with kind of the message of the movie, which is that these people live in hell and their lives are incredibly difficult and they have to use drugs and, you know, get blasted out of their mind just to survive in this awful, awful society. But because the music is so fucking good that people think it's a lot of fun, and it is. I mean, that's the paradox, is that, you know, the music is heavenly and the story itself is about people living in hell.
Yeah, it's kind of like with Fight Club, where if you're too good at showing the lifestyle that you're trying to critique, it ends up just being an endorsement of that lifestyle.
yeah, totally.
What are some of your favorite tracks from the soundtrack? Because I know there's like four Bee Gees tracks, but there's like some other ones that that I think crop up. Beethoven's, like the Beethoven's Fifth one is probably one of my favorites.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can't fucking improve on staying alive. Yeah. I mean, it's the point where, you know, the sequel took its name from that. And I think people probably thought of this movie as staying alive. I realized, and this is why I'm no longer allowed to write about movies professionally, I actually refer to it as staying alive in the headline for my fucking piece on Nathan Raven's Happy Place. And my God, did I feel like a fucking moron, especially since nobody corrected me. But I feel like that is, out of kindness or out of pity that nobody corrected me.
If a writer makes a typo in the woods.
Oh, and, God. I make so many typos that it boggles the mind. I'm a horrible criminal when it comes to the right way. But yeah, it's fucking synonymous. And it, that pulse, that groove, that beat, you know, it's the beat of the city, you know, it's the essence, the energy that it has. I feel like this is kind of the quintessential New York movie. And this made, and I talked about this in my review as well, that, you know, kind of the paradox is that this makes disco seem like, you know, the playground of these broken, debauched, racist hate mongers. And America saw this and like, fuck yeah, sign me up. I want to go to Studio 54. I want to go to 2001. I want to be part of the 65% that that gross dude is fucking.
Yeah. I mean, man, John Travolta, he's so cute, even when he's uttering racial slurs and letting gang rape happen. It's just so dreamy.
Well, and I was thinking about this too, that kind of, again, the big image from this movie is of him in his white suit, you know, that was on the poster, and he's not looking at his dance partner. He's like looking at the camera. And I think that speaks to the fundamental narcissism of the character, but also the way that sort of audiences just saw this beautiful man dancing and not the horrible, horrible things happening around him that he causes. Again, he's not an innocent bystander. He's a terrible person who's very good at dancing.
It really stretches the limits to which, like, feeling bad about the bad things you do absolves you. Because I think that's part of the rehabilitation of the character, right? Is like, man, he does all these terrible things, but he's really conflicted about it, man.
Well, he feels a sense of guilt. You know, he has a sense of honor. He's a fucking dirtbag. But there are things that matter to him, and those things are dancing and looking good.
Is this the first time we've seen like a soundtrack be so massive that it overshadows? I mean, this is what we're talking about, you know, but like, has this happened before where like the soundtrack overshadows the real message of the movie in any kind of way?
Well, I think, again, Superfly is definitely a good illustration of that, where there's this wonderful, wonderful song in Fear of a Black Hat that very much makes fun of that. A Gangster's Life Ain't Fun, which is also kind of making fun of New Jack City and all of these things that, you know, depict these criminal lifestyles as being horrible and wrong, but incredibly exciting and glamorous and something that you totally want to do.
Right.
So again, I feel like it's operating across purposes where the music and the dancing makes all of this seem very seductive and very appealing and very wonderful. And then the actual dialogue and then the story makes it seem like a crucible that people have to go through en route to becoming a man and discovering themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a weirdly complex movie. Like, it's way more complicated than I expected when I first watched it, because, like I said, I hadn't seen it before this, and so I'm kind of gratified that it wasn't just a shallow thing. It was like basically a Taxi Driver in bell bottoms. It's pretty wild. So yeah, I think that's probably we've talked enough about Saturday Night Fever. We should get along to the Cage half of the conversation, and that for this week is 1984's Racing with the Moon.
It was 1943, and young men were counting the days until they would go off to war.
When do you leave?
Next month.
In just 4 short weeks, me and my buddy here are gonna be proud members of the United States Marine Corps.
Get back where you belong!
Yeah, this war is driving them all crazy.
Duck hopper!
The Nazis got this thing, right? It comes right out of the ground and goes right for it. Blows the whole package right off. One second you're John Wayne, and the next you're Minnie Mouse. I'd just hate to see you spend the last few weeks of your manhood chasing something you can't catch.
How'd you like the flowers?
Oh, so you're the one.
Well, at least you're harmless.
So tell me about Michael.
Like, is he my boyfriend or something?
Excuse me?
Oh, I get it. You want a picture for your wallet. You want some girl who's gonna send you flowers and poems.
Don't you ever think about anything but hiking up some girl's dress?
Like what? Look, I've got this under control, all right?
Nikki, you promised.
Stop saying I promised you. Why do you have to come here?
That girl you saw last night, Nikki got her pregnant.
Nathan, why don't you give us the heads up on like what Racing with the Moon is about?
Sure, no problem, no problem at all. This was Richard Benjamin, who was Hollywood's favorite neurotic Jew throughout the late 60s and 1970s. This was his second directorial effort after My Favorite Year in 1982, which is a wonderful, wonderful kind of simpatico project to this. It was kind of an exploration of the early days of television, of Sid Caesar, that world that he kind of created. And this is about World War II. to, specifically two young men who are very, very eager to go off and die for their country. They're just itching. And they're played by a young Sean Penn and a very young Nicolas Cage. And they both have kind of their own journeys through the film. Sean Penn's character falls in love with this very beautiful, sort of ethereal girl played by Elizabeth McGovern. And then Nicolas Cage gets the girl pregnant, and then he has to raise $150 for an abortion.
I'm sensing a theme here.
Yeah, totally. It's kind of crazy.
That's one of the fascinating things about this podcast is figuring out like these inadvertent sort of inroads that they have to each other, like the strange parallels. Even the movies like sort of more than 5 years apart, essentially. It's weird how they sort of match up. So, like you said, Sean Penn and Nick Cage play these young men who like have weeks before they're going to go off to fight in World War II. And it's this kind of early 40s, small town kind of coming of age story. And yeah, it ends up being, you know, it's one of the movies that you would absolutely overlook in a Cage filmography, for instance. But there was a surprising amount of virtue to it. I found it pretty sweet. And they nail the dramatic moments, like especially that stuff near the end with the abortion subplot and all that. And this was written by Steve Kloves, who a lot of people know it as the guy who adapted famous transphobes J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter books to screen, helpfully removing a lot of apparently the latent transphobia. Man, what is it with Brits and transphobia? I have no idea.
I don't know, but she keeps getting worse, man.
She's digging that hole.
She totally came out completely as a TERF. Like, you know, if on your 2019 bingo card you had J.K. Rowling going full TERF, then congratulations.
Yeah, and I mean, it was an easy bet. Like, there were inklings, but this is like the first time that she had actually done that. But that's neither here nor there. We're talking about someone who, as far as we know, is not a transphobe, Nicolas Cage.
You do get a sense. He also went on to write one of my favorite movies from this era, The Fabulous Baker Boys, has, my God, Michelle Pfeiffer, one of the greatest, sexiest performances ever. Jeff Bridges is fucking amazing in that. And you kind of get a sense of what the future holds for him, because there's a very sexy kind of a piano seduction. And then there's also a fairly lengthy Quidditch match, which I thought just kind of came out of nowhere, and they're flying around, and I didn't realize they were muggles. I mean, this is very kind of confusing, and it's a little jarring as well.
Yeah, what house are they in?
It breaks with the tone of the rest of the movie.
But speaking of sexy, though, Nick Cage, well, we've talked about this earlier in the podcast about how attractive these two young men were, and Nick Cage, like, there are legit scenes where he lifts up his shirt to reveal his six-pack abs, and it's just like, I had a tough time thinking straight after.
Well,
that.
And also just the way that he's introduced. Like, he's introduced working at a bowling alley. And this is the olden times in which very, very buff, attractive men, sweating with their muscles bulging and rippling, had to do everything themselves. So, Nicolas Cage is introduced just covered in sweat, his muscles rippling, alongside Sean Penn, who is also a very handsome, very intense, very sexual young man, and who is bowling. Nobody other than Crispin Glover.
Yeah.
Star of The Best of Times. How fucking crazy. And I'm like, oh my God, I had no idea Crispin Glover is in this movie. It's going to be awesome seeing all these weird scenes. He never returns.
Nope.
What?
This is the period in Crispin Glover's career where he thought he could be like a normal actor and like normal people.
This is watching him do this. I'm glad you pointed this out, Clint, because it's like watching someone trying to prevent themselves from turning into a werewolf. He's desperately trying to not be fucking crazy. It's like, all right, Crispin, all you have to do is kind of pick a fight with Nicolas Cage and bowl. And he's like screaming inside.
Must tone down crazy.
Like Ben Stiller and Mystery Men.
It's like,
can
I be eating a cockroach in the scene? It might be good for my character. He might just want to eat cockroaches at random. Doesn't have to be a weird guy. It's a totally organic quirk. Maybe he eats cockroaches. That's all I'm saying.
It's part of my motivation, Richard.
Oobala,
people
come on.
Eat bugs.
It's a fact.
Or maybe he had a very lengthy role, and then Richard Benjamin found out who he had cast. And he's like, you know what? You're good. You're a one-scene wonder, my friend. Too much of you would just overwhelm Nicolas Cage and Sean Penn. And Elizabeth McGovern, who's also a very, very a beautiful and charming woman who had a really amazing 1980s.
She's great. Her
film
movie.
Debut in Ragged. She is. Yeah. She's fantastic.
We talked earlier about this, too, but like it's always nice, especially in this sort of era of Travolta Cage films we're covering, like a lot of the love interests end up not going on to do a lot of stuff afterwards for whatever reason. I have no idea why, but Elizabeth McGovern went on to have a very long, illustrious career, especially in England, and she is on Downton Abbey, or at least was on Downton Abbey. Like, she's been able to maintain a relative profile, you know, since, so that's always kind of, it's a nice change.
Elizabeth McGovern, total recommendation, by the way, is A Shock to the System with Michael Caine.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Ooh. Oh, my God. It's a movie where he gets electrocuted and kind of turns into a crazy person. And the whole movie, he's narrating it, and he's talking about how he's like a wizard. It's fucking wild. And
also, he gets shocked. Does he turn into Crispin Glover?
He's like a Wall Street finance guy or something like that. It's all like, it's like Succession kind of, but just Michael Caine's talking about being a wizard the whole time.
Well, or Vampire's Kiss.
Well, yes. It's also one of those movies about how you can't really succeed in capitalism without becoming a murderous monster.
Absolutely.
which he totally is. But again, I feel like watching this movie, I felt like there were a lot of echoes of kind of the movies that Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro made together. I kind of felt like Sean Penn had kind of the Robert De Niro role, you know, kind of leading man, very intense, very passionate. And then Nicolas Cage was kind of the Joe Pesci sidekick. And literally throughout this entire film,
similar sensibility, similar height.
I just kept waiting for him to die. Because I feel like his character is an innately doomed character. And all these hints of things that he does that are just these reckless chances that he takes. There's a scene involving a train about an hour in. I'm like, oh, he's fucking definitely going to get it now. And now I'm going to 40 minutes without Nicolas Cage. I don't want that. I want this, you know, to be a Nicolas Cage. And he doesn't. But I feel that's one of the interesting ambiguities. And I wonder if there was a draft or multiple drafts of the script where he did die. But they either liked his performance too much or they thought it'd be too much of a downer. Because, yeah, I definitely felt like the energy of the film was a tragic energy. And yes, I was both surprised and oddly disappointed that everybody made it to the end.
Perhaps.
It's one of those movies that sort of reminds me that it's unfortunate there are so few nice movies. Like, this is a nice movie, you know, but like my brain, and I'm sure a lot of movie going brains out there, are trained to like expect the tragedy, anticipating the tragedy. Like, I remember when I watched Boyhood and I'm sitting there watching Boyhood and I'm like, well, someone's getting hit by a car, someone's getting in a car accident, someone's getting cancer. When's the cancer coming? You know?
And this movie's been filmed over 12 years. They can't possibly keep all those actors on hold.
And so for this, it was the same thing. I'm like, okay, so someone's getting crushed by a train. Someone's driving a car off a cliff. Look at all those California cliffs they have, you know? But like, then when it was over with, I was like, oh, fuck, this is just a nice movie. And I forget that like those exist. And I think when I realized that, it's sort of, I was liking the movie fine already. It sort of bumped it up to another level of like, what a pleasant experience it was just watching this nice movie.
Right, exactly. And I mean, it's a good movie to look at too. I mean, the cinematography is by John Bailey, who, Nathan, I know you're a fan of.
Yeah, he did Mishima and The Kid Stays in the Picture and Groundhog Day, which are all great, great films that also look fucking amazing. But yeah, I feel like, you know, they kind of create this nostalgic, sort of romantic vision of America's past without being cloying, without being maudlin and sentimental, except. Yeah. I mean, there are definitely elements of sentimentality in it, the score in particular. But I feel like there's kind of a nice way to kind of undercut that with a lot of kind of genuine emotion. I feel like this is one of those rare movies that wants to be truthful about the teenage experience and what it's like to be a kid, and that doesn't fall into this, you know, vat of cliches and convention, and is actually trying to tell a real story with real emotion. And I feel like it succeeds. You know, it doesn't set the world on fire. It's not the most revolutionary motion picture, but it's a lovely little movie, and very kind of unusual for Nicolas Cage, whose movies tend to be A, not quality motion pictures, and B, fucking crazy, which this movie most assuredly is not.
Yes, it doesn't set the world on fire, but it does start a flame in your heart.
Nailed it. You're going to be on all those movie posters for when it gets re-released next week.
Yeah, well, because I'm looking at the Wikipedia page, and the poster is very uninspiring.
Yes, it's a bad poster. It's like a fake film strip from like an automatic photo booth thing.
Yeah.
Were those around in the 1940s? I can't imagine.
I think that just says this happened in the past and it stars two movie stars.
Yeah. I think they were around in the 80s and that's why they had the film strip in
there. Yeah.
But no, I agree with you. I mean, I think, you know, even among the sort of Norman Rockwell placidity of small town white America in the 40s, I think they do find ways to complicate these kids in ways that make them realistic. I mean, you know, Sean Penn's character, they wanted him to be a jazz pianist, and he sort of rebels against that, but he still has he's got the chops. And then there's Nick Cage, who's the classic sort of fuck up best friend who, like you said, Nathan, is definitely going to get himself killed.
Yeah.
I love the dynamic between the two of them because you can tell that Sean Penn's character, Hop, he feels such a responsibility for Nicky to keep him out of trouble. And you can see the toll that it takes on him to keep him out of trouble. And I remember, like, after they eventually get the abortion done, he blows up at Nicky for his irresponsibility, you know, even just through this whole process. Like, you didn't even open the door for her to let her out of the car, that kind of stuff. Like, I love those kind of grace moments. And, you know, of course, Penn and Cage are very good actors, even this early in their careers. So, like, yeah, those moments really, really work.
Well, I feel like one of the underlying sort of themes of this is, what does it mean to be a man? And Nicolas Cage has a very very kind of rigid sense of, you fight in a war, you're macho, you kill people for your country. And he doesn't realize that it's being a good human being. It's holding the hand of somebody who's about to get an abortion. You know, it's like holding somebody when they cry. You know, like being in touch with your emotions. And I feel like that's, you know, one of the tragic elements of this is that he just doesn't understand himself. And because of that, he makes mistake after mistake after mistake. I also thought it was interesting how he thinks of himself as being a bit of a player.
He's a bit of a sharp character.
Yeah, that there's more, you know, he seems a kind of a con artist. And there's this great scene where he's trying to use Sean Penn's good his pool playing skills to hustle some Navy men, which is another echo from Grand Isle, which we talked about a little while ago. Where he also was a Marine who did not take too kindly to these Navy gentlemen.
Did you theorize that, like, that character in Grand Isle is this?
I think all of Nicolas Cage's characters are related. They all inhabit the Cage multiverse, which is also the Spider-Man multiverse. It overlaps very nicely there. But so there's this great, very funny scene where, yeah, they try to hustle these Navy men and discover, to their horror, that they're the ones who are getting hustled because they're not that smart and they're not that good at pool. And that's part of growing up. It's realizing what a dumbass you are and how all of your confidence and all of your cockiness is incredibly misplaced.
That's another thing. It's kind of one of those, again, those slice of life movies where so much of the actual events of the movie just kind of fade into this miasma of pleasantness. I mean, I guess there is sort of the romance between Sean Penn and Elizabeth McGovern, which I felt was fairly sensitively handled. Like, there is sex in it, but it's not lascivious. It's not, like, titillating.
Well,
it's
felt like
very sort of soft focus dissolve kind of
everything
thing.
Everything is earned here, yeah.
Oh, very much. I felt like it was like Valley Girl. You know, it's like this nudity is earned. Like, this ups the stakes. This shows the intimacy. It shows the intensity. It shows the fragility of the relationship, as opposed to get a load of these titties, which is the message between a lot
they
of the nudity in teen
film.
Movies.
I mean, that was also on the poster.
This is a teen sex movie. It's not a teen sex comedy.
Right.
But it's kind of a teen sex earnest drama.
Like, I'm just reminded of, because just like, I think it was either yesterday or 2 days ago, there was a tweet from Richard Brody, who I love reading but rarely agree with, and he was just talking about how, like, there's never a reason for nudity in film ever.
What?
No.
Yeah, and I was like, man, I think that beard is starting to take oxygen from your brain, dude. Like,
yeah. The 12-year-old me wants to punch him in the face for making that assertion. Teenagers need to get through life, damn it.
Give us the butts.
We can't live by porn alone.
This movie's like such a great example of it too, because it's so natural, and yeah, it's not shows them titties. It's also pretty fair, you know, as far as the Sean Penn ass and beanbag department.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So, like, there are times, Mr.
Very
Brody,
equal opportunity nudity.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, I get it from, like, you know, lascivious, like, slasher movie points of view or whatever he was, I guess, referencing. I don't know what he was actually referencing, but, like, it just, this movie is a great example of why he's wrong.
Yeah. Although I did think that that they added comical sound effects to the sex scene.
the slime whistle was a weird choice.
It was. Like, wait, does he have an erection? Does he not have an erection? This is very confusing.
It's very odd. It clashed tonally with the rest of the motion picture. But but like, let's go back to the train, because one image that I loved that was like particularly on the nose is in the, like the opening credits where we were just watching the train go by, and at the end we see that it's like squished all those pennies into the
right
thing. Yeah. Just like our boys in war, right?
Yeah.
So that was another thing I thought was gonna like foreshadow Nick Cage getting killed, but who knows? We don't know if they live in war, you know.
Yeah, again, in my mind, Nicolas Cage gets killed within a week of going.
We
to
never
war.
Got a Racing with the Moon. They get killed in basic training.
He's like, I'll take on all the Germans myself. It's like, no, come back here.
Stop it.
I always get real anxiety when they have these sequences of like putting pennies on train tracks, and I was just reminded of why. And Nathan, it was because I started reading your big piece about the Simpsons episodes you were watching.
Yeah.
So I was thinking Simpsons. I don't remember where it is, but there is a gag somewhere in that show where someone puts pennies down on a track and the train hits it and it like totally derails. And it's just a huge like disaster. And I know it's from a cartoon, but every time I see that happening in a live action movie, I'm like, oh my God, now it's going to derail. And then I have to think like, no, that's a Simpsons joke. Never mind. That doesn't happen. That
Twist, that train was Snowpiercer.
Well, we did mention Michael Madsen.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Not his screen debut, one of his very earliest roles as a very, very young, yeah, very handsome war veteran who lost a limb. And the war is kind of a vision of all of the bad things that can happen to you, I think, makes them feel a little less gung-ho about going off to fight. And Carol Kane, was she in this
yeah,
one?
Yeah, baby Carol
oh,
Kane.
Oh,
yeah,
the prostitute?
She's so good. And she like has one or two scenes, and she's so funny and so interesting and such a life of her own. And then she disappears.
I'd be like, no, Sean Penn, date Carol Kane, please.
Seriously. Or Nicolas Cage, come on. She's too adorable and too delightful.
No, you know what should have happened? Crispin Glover and Carol Kane should have gotten
together. There it is.
And they're like the third couple that we're following.
You know, it's interesting because I'm looking at the runtime again. It's an hour and 48 minutes. And the more we talk about this, the more this movie kind of reeks of deleted scenes.
In
one way or another. And
I'm not opposed to a movie being an hour 48 minutes long.
No, neither am I. But in this instance, we're talking about some interesting threads here, and there are some actors that suspiciously vanish, especially for like the time. Carol Kane, I guess, specifically. But release the Benjamin cut, man. Like, that's a hashtag. Release the Benjamin cut.
Everyone's clamoring for it.
Totally.
And I totally miss Dana Carvey in this. I he's apparently in this, and I
know I don't know what that's about.
Yeah,
either.
He plays a character named Babyface, and I was
Babyface.
That's from the mobster subplot that we lost. Another, like, I guess a cameo that I care about is that there's like a dance where there's like a military guy who, you know, I think it's like maybe escorts Elizabeth McGovern to the dance or something like that.
Oh,
I
her date, because it's a weird like Cage in that scene, or Sean Penn rather thinks that he's going there like for Elizabeth McGovern, and then there's like this other friend of hers, and then this hunk comes in and is Elizabeth McGovern's date.
And Meade, being a gigantic Star Trek nerd, recognized said hunk from Star Trek III: The Search for Spock, where he has a very fun scene where Nichelle Nichols gets to like intimidate him into a closet as sort of a way to show like how the old folks still get it done.
Right. Oh, yeah. Oh, wow, dude. Great pull.
Yeah.
So this is apparently Steve Kloves. This is the first screenplay that he had produced. He was 24 years old when this was made, which means that he was probably 22 or 23 when he sold it. He was a bit of a wunderkind.
Not too shabby.
Definitely go on to do a lot of interesting. Because in Wonder Boys, he adapted that. And that's just a lovely, lovely little character study.
That's not what's funny,
Wonder Boys. That's a lot of fun.
That's another movie, Wonder Boys, that is really great and kind of like forgotten by time in a way.
Yeah, just, it's just a rambling kind of movie. I think that's it, you know? And I think Sally Jesse Raphael glasses, Michael Douglas, they became iconic. They're in the Smithsonian, right next to her own.
I don't know how we forgot about Wonder Boys. It has Iron Man and Spider Man.
And fucking Ant-Man in it.
And dude. Ant-Man.
Ant-Man's
right.
Dad, that's true. Jesus. And Katie Holmes, who was the girl from the Batman movie.
Yeah. Oh, Rachel Dawes, of course.
Yeah, Rachel Dawes. I love that we're in this era now where we can just describe movie casts by what superheroes they play.
Yeah. And it's bad, though, if you can't pinpoint whether or not someone is. And I was in a screening a couple days ago. I was seeing the new film, The Burnt Orange Heresy. And Donald Sutherland has a small role in it. And for like 5 minutes, I'm sitting there while this movie is still on, just talking to my head like, was Donald Sutherland in a Marvel movie? And it went on for way too fucking long. And finally, I was like, I don't think he was. Also, this is unacceptable.
Yeah, what are you doing, sir?
Well, we've reached the point where you could probably spend your entire career just acting in comic book movies.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just like you have a career where you do nothing but reality television.
Totally.
You know?
I feel like if I'm Robert Downey Jr. right now and Doolittle's about to come out, I'm thinking I should have stuck to superhero movies.
Is it being able to talk to the animals a superhero?
Perhaps.
A superpower of sorts.
It's the DCU, the Doolittle Cinematic Universe.
Well, they have the crossover with Cats. This is going to be amazing.
Right? Oh my God. Cats, you guys.
Dude, I'm seeing it Saturday.
I'm still reeling from Cats.
I'm excited. Yeah.
I'm pretty proud of myself that the way we have scheduled our theater going this weekend, my wife and I are seeing Cats first and then Star Wars the next day.
Oh, man. I saw them at the on the same day. The screenings are the same day.
Dude, this very famous Chicago back-to-back that I saw so many people tweeting about, I was very envious.
It was wild. And they're both very bad movies in very different ways. Yeah, but that's neither here nor there.
But I hear they really stick it to the SJWs. Another new one.
I mean, if you're a person of color in this movie, get ready to be shoved off to the background. We'll even introduce new characters that are people of color to give them 5 lines. Yeah, Racing with the Moon. Nick Cage is neither in Cats or Star Wars, but you know what can we do?
He's not in Cats or Star Wars now.
Yeah, you know. Yet. Give it time.
I'm betting there's already somebody who has put Nicolas Cage's face on all of those cats. And it will be pure nightmare fuel.
I'm kind of surprised on some level that he is not in Cats.
Yeah, it's weird. It would definitely be in his wheelhouse to be in a crazy movie that's terrible that everybody's talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a horrible, horrible idea that anybody could see was a horrible idea from, you know, a million miles away.
Yeah, but somehow it's still like you cannot peel your eyes away. It feels like you know, either that picture of Alex DeLarge in the Ludovico machine or whatever. It feels like that for 100 minutes. It's blissfully short. Like, it's only 100 minutes long, Cats. But
awesome. I'm fucking Mr. Mistopheles.
Would you say you have a lot of memories of seeing Cats?
And they go for, like, Jennifer Hudson's going for the Anne Hathaway and Les Mis kind of thing. It's not all down her cat face.
Or the Jennifer Hudson in Dreamgirls.
True, but like since it's Tom Hooper.
Emoted. Yes.
Yeah.
No,
exactly.
The reason he was making that comparison, Nathan, was because Jennifer Hudson's character was singing from inside a cat box, much like Anne Hathaway's coffin.
Oh my God.
Yes.
I feel like that's a punk band, Anne Hathaway's coffin.
Anne Hathaway's coffin.
Definitely.
Anne Hathaway's coffin. Racing with the Moon. How does it end?
It ends with a kind of a big question mark. They're going off to war.
Very happy about it. They're gleefully
super
running.
Pumped to die.
Yeah.
Well, World War
II. Like the first act of Starship Troopers.
It was the good war, you know? And only bad people died in World War II.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I like the people who didn't get captured.
Oh, God.
They are the best.
Well, now that we've talked about both of these movies, we should probably get down to our cage match. And we have to evaluate which of these movies is better in whatever vague metrics we're evaluating that by. Nathan, what do you think?
This is an easy one for me again. Racing with the Moon, I really like. It is a good, good movie. You should check it out if you're intrigued. Although, it's like we said, it's very atypical for Cage and being quality and non-zen. But Saturday Night Fever is one of my favorite movies. It's a masterpiece. You can watch it over and over and over again and get something new and interesting and weird every time. John Travolta's performance is fucking magnetic. You know, that is a movie star right there. And I think one thing that kind of works in its favor is that none of the other actors really went on to do anything. So there's nothing to take you out of that reality. You can just believe that the priest is the priest, that Double J is Double J, you know. So yeah, I'm definitely Saturday Night Fever, although Racing with the Moon, also a very good movie.
Andrew, what about you?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a no contest thing. What's rad is that, Racing with the Moon was a great find, and I want to tell people about it. But, you know, like I was saying when we were talking about Saturday Night Fever, like, it's such an incredible movie that's unfortunately remembered for its music alone. And so I'm like going to make it my mission to spread the word about how it's a much better movie that goes beyond the disco dancing that you've seen on, you know, countless posters and parodies and whatnot. It's a truly excellent, top tier New York movie.
It's also just such a 70s movie too.
Such
a character. Oh, so about, you know, these gritty outsiders on the fringes of American life, and they're hopeless, doomed dreams. So yeah, I loved it so much on that level, and I feel like it's so much more a new Hollywood 1970s movie than it is a fun musical blockbuster, which it also became because it was so good, and the elements that people really loved, people allowed people to forget about all the elements that are just incredibly harsh and bleak and brutal.
Yeah, exactly. I'm inclined to agree with the both of you. Like, Racing with the Moon is a neat find, and it's a pleasant movie, but Saturday Night Fever, like, it changed pop culture in such an indelible way.
Yeah,
you kind of have to bow down, like everyone at 2001 Odyssey whenever Tony Manero walks in and sort of, you know, bow to his prowess and the skill of it and the vibrancy of it. One thing I don't know if we actually talked about this when we were talking about Saturday Night Fever. Did we talk about the way John Travolta eats pizza?
I don't know if we did.
It's two slices stacked together.
Oh man, absolutely.
On top of each other. It's like that famous hot dog thing from Joe Dater. Do you eat your two hot dogs with them one on top of each other or around the sides? And from Chicago, you side by side. For me, you got a nice, you know, bun there. You got your Vienna beef. Talking about sort of the incredible influence of Saturday Night Fever, a movie we're going to be talking about next episode, Grease. It's a totally 1960s movie with disco songs in it, because people loved John Travolta and disco, and they did not care if it made no fucking sense whatsoever for a movie set in the early 60s to have disco. But yeah, Grease is totally a disco song in a rock and roll retro movie.
All right, well, congratulations, Saturday Night Fever. You will be moving on to whatever round we do whenever we eventually, like in 7 years or something.
This is so much better than those Oscar nominations and being added to the National Film Registry.
Yes. We're working on our like 50 film shortlist right now. Before we leave you, we have a mailbag. If you want to email us questions at travoltacagepod@gmail.com, you can do so and we'll read it on the show. And we have our very first one.
Yay!
This is from our friend Jeremy Moran, who has written us before on Happy Cast and is a wonderful bloke. Good day, gentle Ben. I love the podcast, but it stirs within me a question regarding the unique talents of Mr. Travolta and Mr. Cage. But before I get into that, I just want to let you know that I believe that Eddie Murphy's ability to portray every single member of the Klump family is one of the greatest acting feats of all time. We all know that Cage and Travolta are tremendously talented actors who are up to the level of Eddie Murphy's abilities. They are able to transform into different characters and hide completely within those personas. So my hypothetical question to you is this. Two films are announced. One film stars Travolta playing every member of a family, and one film stars Cage playing every member of a family. Which film would you rather see? Or would you rather both families appear in the same film and perhaps duel with each other in a Hatfield-McCoy fashion? Enjoy chewing this one over, Jer. Well, I think he answered his own question, right? It's obviously the face-off family style.
Absolutely.
The face-off Family Feud.
I would like to see these characters face off.
Indeed. It's
you
also
can't
like
see
a...
it, but we're all like, you know, gesturing against away from our face with our
it would be like a wedding movie, right? And these are like the first time the two families are meeting.
Yes. Oh.
Because those movies are always terrible and they always make a lot of money.
Absolutely.
I think that people don't kind of realize that, like, even fucking Bride Wars, there's probably somewhere in, like, the Ukraine who, like, is a multimillionaire because, you know, it sold so many goddamn DVDs of Bride Wars. It's like Christmas movies. It's the same goddamn thing. Do you know how much fucking, like, Christmas Vacation? Like, that goddamn movie. Like, 30 years later, the merchandising... Ugh, makes me very angry.
It's the merchandising of that movie was something that surprised me. I've been a fan of that movie for a very long time. But now, like, just the amount of t-shirts and mugs and fucking shit that you can buy for people around
teddy
that
bears?
Movie.
And again, like, these characters are disgusting. Yeah, John Hughes exactly. has so much contempt for all of these characters and all of these poor people. And they're like, look, here's the, you know, rapey uncle, and he's a teddy bear. And you know, you can snuggle with him, and he plays, you know, a Christmas song. It's like, no, this is wrong on so many different levels.
Yeah, it reminds also just, me of, in Illinois, there are, like, signs, the electronic signs that say to, like, get off your phone, or like whenever Amber Alerts are happening or whatever.
Right.
There is one that constantly crops up that says, Cousin Eddie says Twitter's full.
Oh my God.
Get off your phone.
That's
who is this for? Anyone who gets that joke is not on Twitter.
Well, and the fact, it's also interesting that the actor who played Cousin Eddie would go on to be way crazier and way grosser than Cousin Eddie.
Oh, he makes Cousin Eddie look like a fucking rocket scientist.
Oh, my God. Have you seen his Twitter feed? I wish Twitter was full, so you did. You'll be astonished to hear that he's out of his goddamn mind and a huge Donald Trump supporter.
Oh, I'm
that
sure.
I knew. Yeah.
I mean, those two things are kind of
his wife. Know, they have a fascinating relationship as well, and I feel like somebody should tell that story, but they'd probably end up getting murdered by Randy Quaid at some point.
Or the Star Whackers, dude. You got to watch
that's
the Star
true.
Oh man. Well, I think that pretty much wraps up this episode of Travolta Cage. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it anytime.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Why don't you tell people where they can find your stuff?
Totally. Yeah, you can find all things We Hate Movies over at whmpodcast.com. New episodes every Tuesday. And over on our Patreon, patreon.com/wehatemovies, where we do more bonus episodes. And we have tons of sideshows about Star Trek and Star Wars. We are just wrapping up our first season coverage of The Mandalorian next week, which has been a lot of fun. We do a show called The Mandalorian Half Hour. And I just released a thing a few hours ago, Animation Damnation, which is a show where we talk about our favorite bad cartoon kinds of things, where we're doing seasonally appropriate Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the Rankin and Bass stop motion, so that's a lot of fun.
So you tear it a new asshole?
It's We Love Movies Month, but we wound up being way harsher on it than I thought we were going to.
Yeah, it's kind of a fucked up story. When you
yeah,
think
no,
about
it's
it.
It's fucking really twisted.
It's like supposed to teach children nice messages, and it's like this bizarre bullying and being rewarded, and
yeah,
people
it's
liking
too little
you
too
only
late.
Because you can save them. It's a very fucked
the ultimate
up story.
Lesson is isn't the ultimate lesson kind of be nice to minorities. They might be able to do something.
Yeah. Pretty much.
You might need them at some point for purely pragmatic reasons. Don't be an asshole.
It's the Christmas equivalent of arguing that immigration's good because they fuel the economy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, totally. And it's also features, and you will forget this, that fucking little elf takes pliers and pulls all the teeth out of that abominable snowman's mouth.
Oh, Jesus. God.
It's bone chilling. It's some real fucking Silence of the Lambs shit. And
real
there's
marathon,
a character.
Man.
There's a
That's
character named safe. Clarice in it. It's,
well,
it's,
there's something kind of inherently kind of spooky and creepy about Rankin Bass in particular.
Yes.
And I feel like, yeah, this seems like it kind of takes that to a disturbing level.
For more, see Rudolph's Shiny New Year, the sequel.
Oh, God.
Which features Father Time, Baby New Year, and you guessed it, Benjamin Franklin for some reason.
Oh, great. Well, I can't wait to check that out. But anyway, yes, thanks for listening to Travolta Cage. You can find us on Twitter at Travolta Cage. You can email us at TravoltaCagePod@gmail.com. You can find these episodes on your favorite podcatcher, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever it may be. Whatever you do subscribe to us on, please give us a rating and a review. Anything helps us out. You can find our full episodes and Nathan's writings on all these movies and shows and whatnot at NathanRabin.com. Thanks so much for listening, and I gotta go poo. I forget how the line
I'm gonna go strut.
Yeah, I'm gonna go strut.